I think we have reached the point with just a closing service to go and a gala supper that the sense that we've accomplished a great deal. For the final press briefing, we've invited the Archbishop to come as the president of the Anglican Consultative Council. He'll make some opening comments, and then, as has been our norm, we'll take questions one by one. We've got about 25 to 30 minutes for the press briefing because of other duties that the Archbishop has. So, again, thank you for coming, and I'll turn it now to the Archbishop.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Thank you all for being here. Very briefly, I think I'd want to note some of the things that have been new about the ACC meeting this time. Several aspects of the way we've met have been attempts to build on lessons learned at the Lambeth Conference last year and in other contexts. And I'd want to note just a couple of things. One is the way in which the networks of the communion have related to this meeting. Instead of a formal report from these networks, we've had the opportunity, you forgive the jargon, of something rather more interactive. That is, people have been able to engage with the networks in a sort of fair, almost, in the first weekend when stalls were set out, and then to choose which they were going to engage with in more depth in the sessions in the days that followed. This, I think, has generally given people a sense that the networks are genuinely doing what the communion wants to do, and they're part of what we are doing, not what some they are doing. I think that's been very good for our sense of what we do in various kinds of outreach. And personally, I was particularly struck by the reports from the proposed health network and the environmental network as particularly engaging in this respect. The second new thing about the way we've done our business is, of course, the discernment groups. This, again, reflects something of the experience last summer at Lambeth of the Indaba groups and underlines the importance at meetings like this of not simply processing people into plenaries all the time or leaving the relation building entirely to the Bible study groups. Medium-sized groups in which very tough issues can be confronted without having to take votes have proved, I think, very constructive in these settings, and the feedback that we've had, particularly this morning, from those groups has been they've been a very valued part of how we've conducted this meeting. Most ACC meetings have had some level of engagement with the life of the local church, and that's not been in itself a new thing about this meeting. Many here, though, would, I think, say that they've experienced that at some depth, with great warmth, and, of course, with an opportunity, again, for some interaction with our hosts last weekend. So, in brief, I'd simply want to say that, in these respects at least, this meeting has built some very solid relationships with the local church, with one another. It hasn't necessarily dealt with the problems that face the communion once and for all. It would be a very fortunate meeting that claimed to be able to do that. Nonetheless, it has, I think, deepened our sense of obligation and obligation to and involvement with each other. And in that respect, it's something for which I give thanks. But I'll be very happy to take your questions at this point.
I think we'll go this case from left to right, so Colin, we'll turn to you first, if we could.
Colin on the far left.
Thank you very much, Paul. The meeting has affirmed the moratoria, which wasn't a surprise. And clearly two of the moratoria affect lesbian and gay people in the communion more than other groups. I wonder what the wriggle room is for lesbian and gay people between moratoria which apply to provinces and therefore to authorities within those provinces, and lesbian and gay people who are partnered, who seek blessings, who are ordained and partnered, who want to be ordained, and who want it now, understandably. How are they going to live through the extended period of the moratoria and reflection through the listening process?
The moratoria are fairly specific, I think, in their direction. They're about the authorization of blessings, they're about the election of persons to the episcopate. I think the spirit of the moratoria would suggest restraint in the ordination of partnered gay persons more widely, the spirit of the moratoria. And that is certainly the feel of the discussions around that. I think that, in some ways, the difficult message to get across, something which I noted briefly last night and have mentioned on other occasions, the difficult message to get across is that holding back on ordination ought not to be seen as a denial of the place of lesbian and gay people in the life of Christ's body. These are our brothers and sisters. They're there. They have gifts that Christ wants to give us. And that's, to me, axiomatic. That should instantly translate into, and forgive my saying this, but it sometimes sounds like an absolute right to ordination, is not so self-evident, and I think that's what we were trying to maintain.
Robert and Linda Beverly.
Archbishop, on Friday, you said that a federation in the Anglican Communion is possible. What role do you think the Archbishop of Canterbury would play in that sort of federation?
That's a very interesting question. A federation, I suppose I'm using a shorthand here and saying, if we're not a communion in the full-blooded sense of recognizing each other's orders, recognizing each other's ministries, sharing all aspects of ecclesial life, what then are we? Federation is the word that seems to come to mind here. And I was trying to say last night, I think, in the presidential address, that you could imagine a federal structure in which the current instruments of communion, the ACC and the Lambeth Conference, still had a role, and presumably the Archbishop of Canterbury would still have some sort of convening role in that. What the Archbishop would not then be in federation is the focus of communion in the same sense, the same universal sense. I have no alternative method to propose. That is what we, as a communion, have settled on. I think to change that wouldn't be up to me, but would be up to the council as a whole.
In your presidential address last night, I took away from that you thought that perhaps a federation was inevitable. Is that
No, point? No. I said it was possible. That there were some things which made it look likely. But it was not what I wanted or hoped for. But, sorry, did you want to follow on from that?
Well, I heard you say that it wasn't what you would like to see happen, but what I took away from the presidential address, and I may have been wrong, that was that it was an inevitability. And I wondered, though, just moving forward, that being not what you said, but if it does become a federation, will that sort of set up a system where the top tier may be, or the bottom tier may feel discriminated against?
Top tier and bottom tier isn't, of course, the language that I used or would want to use. There are groups of, in such a situation, there would be, I imagine, groups of Anglicans associated for different purposes in different ways. Top and bottom suggests very much an inner circle and outer circle. And I think the way I put it was, those provinces who want to sign up to the covenant want to create a more intense relationship between them, a fuller and freer exchange between them. Others are not choosing that. And the difficult question then is, what is the best, the most constructive relation between those who do choose and those who don't? But I don't see it as a top and bottom business.
Mary Frances Schomburg, Episcopal News Service. The Episcopal Church's General Convention meets in little more than 2 months from now. There will probably be some action on the resolution asking for restraint on the part of bishops and standing committees in approving ordination to the episcopate of partnered people. Do you see any action to negate that resolution as also possibly pushing us towards this federation and these differing levels of commitment to each other?
I think action to negate that resolution would instantly suggest to many people in the communion that the Episcopal Church would prefer not to go down the route of closer structural bonds and that particular kind of mutual accountability. That's how it would be received, I think.
Colin, back to you.
England. The legal advice seems to be that we wouldn't be able to sign up to the
covenant.
Covenant, thank you, Ryan.
You've heard it.
Legally. Is that true of the...
That's not actually the legal advice. The legal advice is that certain procedures would have to be followed in synod, but that would only be true if the covenant were itself a legally binding document which in some way altered the canonical provisions of the Church of England. So it requires a certain level of consent within the synodical process and a certain time scale.
Archbishop, criticism has been raised concerning the processes for Friday's vote on the covenant. Even criticism just recently, Rose Hudson of the Church of England said there was concern, her discernment group, about those processes. My question is, given your role in that meeting on Friday and the times that you chose to speak, did you know that the amendments to Resolution B would most likely send the covenant back and not forward to the provinces?
Well, that's what the resolution said. My interventions on Friday were three. My first intervention was to say why I was not persuaded that Resolution A was a good idea. And in that brief intervention, I explained why I thought that actually we were very unlikely to profit from sending Section 4 back. I would not have voted, I didn't vote for Resolution A. After lunch, with the procedural tangle emerging about A, B, and C, I suggested that a practical way of dealing with this was to allow those parts of Resolution C, which represented bits of A, to be moved as an amendment to B. That would be a tidier way of doing it. It would allow people to get A out of the way. Also, I have to say, the proposed clauses which Archbishop Aspinall brought forward seemed to me less prejudicial to the future of Section 4 of the Covenant document than Resolution A. I didn't vote for those amendments and couldn't have because of my objection to sending the thing back anyway. But I thought that procedurally we ought to have a tidy way of doing it. I said explicitly in that second intervention, sorry, this all sounds a bit complicated, isn't it, in that second intervention, that I would expect if Resolution A fell, those two clauses would be moved. I think that was my phraseology, would be moved as amendments to Resolution B. When they were moved, and there was an attempt to say they were out of order, I reminded the meeting of what I'd said, that this was what I thought we had understood in asking for those things to be moved as amendments to B, rather than either in the form of A, the full form of A, or in a separate Resolution C. And yes, of course, to put it in that way, does bring home how very complicated our procedures can get. Nothing irregular happened on Friday, but it was extremely complex to explain because the business was complex and the wording was sensitive in all of those things. The point was raised, the original form of Resolution A, that the word addendum downgraded Section 4 of the Covenant. So it's not where I would have wanted us to get. But the timetable, of course, remains in place. And we are already looking in some detail at the dates before the end of this year when we can put that to sleep, get the business sorted and send it forward. Also, of course, that's part of the background of my remarks last night about the need for everyone in the community to start discussing now. It's not as if there's some sort of embargo on talking about the covenant and a province's attitude to it until the final form of Section 4 is sent out. One last thing, I'm sorry, because you did ask a general question to start with, and I'm rabbiting on here. I said yesterday that we probably needed, for everyone's comfort, better briefing on process matters. The point was also raised this morning in discussion that maybe we should look at other ways of doing the resolution business than simply the parliamentary model, which some of us are familiar with and some of us aren't very.
Pardon my ignorance, but if the communion were to turn into a federation, what process will take place? And as a follow-up to that, what might it be modeled after? There have been talks in the past about modeling it, let's say, after the Lutheran World Federation.
It's an interesting analogy because, of course, within the Lutheran World Federation, there are churches which have a closer relationship with each other, like the Porvo churches in Scandinavia and the Baltic. And there are churches which, while part of the same federation, don't have that common ministry and mutual agreement which links those churches in Scandinavia and the Baltic to the churches of the United Kingdom. So there might be something to be looked at there, a model of a federation in which some participants, in addition to their common membership of the Federation, enjoy a closer relationship with one another. Once again, I hope we don't go there, but that would be one analogue, and it's an interesting one to raise.
How would all of this conversation about what shape the Anglican Communion takes, whether it moves closer to a church or closer to a federation, on the ground, day-to-day, all over the world, Anglicans doing the work of God, how does this all affect that mission, or does it?
I suspect that for 90% of Anglicans across the world, it doesn't. People will do the work of God as they see fit, in prayer and in dedication, in their local settings. For those local settings to be most fully enriched by their presence in the body of Christ, spiritually, not just materially, I believe very strongly that it is better to have a closer communion relationship than not. I believe that with all my heart. That is for the health of our global communion. A lot will still go on, as you hint, whatever happens there. And God finds ingenious ways of getting around our ecclesiastical dead ends, so history suggests.
There seems to be a general consensus among the participants at this ACC meeting that the meeting has in fact met well, which could probably not be said for the last ACC meeting. There seems to have been a general consensus at the primates meeting in Alexandria that they met well, which could not be said for Dar es Salaam and Drummond team. What is your sense of this change? Why is this a change in the mood of the Anglican community right now?
Some of it is probably simply the healing effect of time. The issues are not quite as raw as they were for some people, at least. Though I realise there are areas where, you know, they don't get any easier, particularly around the sort of cross-provincial situation. However, I think that after the very stressful experience of Dar es Salaam, especially, the primates realized that they did have to work and pray a bit more constructively together and approach each other a bit more patiently without softening the disagreements. I think what happened in Alexandria was a real attempt to make room for each other in the discussion. And I noted very particularly one morning a couple of incidents with one primate from a very sort of marked position within the communion, taking care to say, but I think what we need to say in order to include my brother here would be, and the same being reciprocated in an hour or so later in another direction. And that making room to make sure that people's concerns really are there, and that whatever we say together is something we can say with integrity. I thought that was good. And I hope that the Lambeth experience helped give a bit of energy to that, a bit of a sense of what would help us as a Christian body. not just what would solve the problems, but what would actually help us as a Christian body. And I think that's been very much around here.
Thank you. I think we need to bring this to an end, time-wise and that sort of thing.
There was one question which I realized I hadn't answered from you, which was about processes. And I didn't answer it, of course, partly because I have no idea how we might sort of reinvent ourselves if it came to that. I don't really know. I suspect that this council would have a very considerable role in that. But at present, we're launched on a process around the Covenant and the Windsor Continuation Group, which will have its own life, its own energy, certainly in the next few years. I'm not looking beyond that. I'm looking to make that process work effectively in the first instance.